From Silicon Valley, California, this is Fresh Dialogues. Dick Henning is founder of Foothill College's Celebrity Forum series. The series was cited as the best speaker series in the nation, and in 1985, Dick received the Drew Pearson Award for the most outstanding programmer in America. Silicon Valley columnist Lee Wymers has described Henning as a man with a magic touch who enriches our intellectual life by bringing up close people who might not otherwise come here. People like Margaret Thatcher, Mikhail Gorbachev, Bill Clinton, Jerry Lewis, and Desmond Tutu. Thank you for joining me today on Fresh Dialogues, Dick.
Thank you, Allison. It's my pleasure. And I paid Lee Wymers to say that.
You know. You did. I know you guys are good friends. In 1968, you were Dean of Student Services at Foothill College, and you created the first Celebrity Forum to calm some student unrest, offering lectures by Louis Leakey and Alistair Cook in the college gym. Can you tell me about that unrest and how your plan worked?
Well, there were students who knew the law, and they knew that they didn't have to buy a student body card, so they were trying to convince the student body not to buy them. And they were $20 each, and so we decided, with the help of students and faculty members, to put together a series of various things, series of rock concerts, a series of dramas, a series of speakers. So we put together a series so that the students could actually see that the student body card was really worth a great deal. Now, frankly, I think it was the rock concerts that attracted most students, and we had the biggest of all. We had Tower Power, we had the Grateful Dead, we had Janis Joplin, we had the big names of that time in the late 60s and early 70s. And it worked. We got right back up to 100% or near 100% of student body card sales.
And now, fast forward 40 years, you've moved out of the college gym to the Flint Center in Cupertino, where you present Celebrity Forum to over 7,000 people on three consecutive nights. Every year, you bring seven or eight outstanding leaders in politics, business, and the arts to speak in Silicon Valley. Why do you think it's grown so exponentially?
The most important reasons are the quality of the people who live in this area, particularly the northern part of Santa Clara County. They're highly educated. 100% of our people have attended college. We have one-third have higher degrees, and there's about 25% who have doctorates or MDs or the equivalent of that, law degrees. So it's highly educated, and because people are highly educated, they want to keep on top of things. They want to be current, and they're very inquisitive. So they're very supportive of something like this activity. It won't work everywhere, but it really works well right here in the Bay Area.
Can you tell me about the turning point for you? When did it go from being just one of your tasks of your job to your full-time focus? At what point did you say, this is my calling?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there were many times when I felt like giving it up. When we moved to the Flint Center at the beginning, we had 500 people attend, and there are 2,580 seats at that time. And it was very depressing. I mean, you walk out on the stage and you see, you know, in a hall that big, you see a smattering of people and all. And I sat down one time and thought, you know, should I continue doing this? And I thought, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm really going to do it big. I'm just going to take a chance and spend some big money and bring in some big names and see what happens. So I took that chance, and we filled up the auditorium. And that was when I knew this thing is going to last.
And when you say big money, what was your budget then, and what's your budget today?
Well, that was $15,000 for Bob Hope, and I never paid more than $3,000 for a speaker. That's the biggest change in this business, is that when I first started, and you mentioned that I started with Louis Leakey, and I ended that year with Alistair Cook. And by the way, the next night, Alistair Cook went down to be with Bobby Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles when he was assassinated. That was June 5th, 1968. Every speaker was $600, and they paid their own airfare, and they paid their own travel expenses, and we would put them up in homes in the hills here with well-to-do people in Los Altos Hills. And so we paid only $600 flat. But the escalation of fees is the things that has killed off a lot of these series around the nation. It's just gotten way out of hand. The fees today can go up as high as $150,000 per night.
And why is that, Dick?
It's the conferences and conventions and the big businesses. And when you're planning a convention, you're IBM or one of the big city banks, or when you have a convention, your budget may be $4 or $5 million because you're bringing in your big customers. You're also rewarding your most important employees. And if a speaker costs $100,000 in order to get Colin Powell or George Bush, or it's not a big percentage of your budget. But that business is starting to dwindle. The last couple of months, this recession that we're in has really hurt the speaker's business. And we're hoping that some of these fees will start going the other way, and that is down, because they haven't gone down since I've been in the business. They've always gone up.
Do you find you're in a negotiable situation because it's Silicon Valley, because it's Foothill? Can you negotiate?
There was a time, I think, that helped, but not anymore. These people are in it for the business. They're making millions, and I'm sure you've seen the reports on, like, Bill Clinton had picked up $14 million. This is huge business, so they don't care where they go. In the old days, they were, you know, choosy because they weren't being paid that much, but now, if you're going to pay me the same amount of money, I don't care where I go. I got a microphone and a glass of water, and I'll go there and pick up my money and leave. I think the biggest advantage I have in terms of negotiating fees is that I have 3 nights in a row, and you get to stay in the same hotel room. You're free during the day. There's no obligation. You're coming to the celebrity forum, giving your speech, and you're gone. You're back in your hotel room, and they're picking up their almost a full fee, a discounted fee for 3 evenings. Now, it is true, of course, Silicon Valley is known throughout the world, and it does have some appeal for certain people, particularly foreign people who would say, I'm going to appear in your country, and Silicon Valley is certainly one place I would like to see. The average has constantly gone up. I said the average about 50,000 was last year. And I can remember it was 10 years ago, it was 35,000. And 10 years before that, the average was around 20,000. So this is just escalating. And you cannot raise the price of the celebrity forum fast enough to keep up with those escalating. But the celebrity forum is a moneymaker. The college doesn't care about the money. It's nice that they have it, and they use it for neat things. But they would continue the celebrity forum if it didn't make any money.
Why is that?
Because there are so many added value. We meet people who we never meet. Well, we have had donations from people who would never think about donating to community college. And we're talking about donations in the millions, not just $50, $500. This is big money, and it would not have come about if we hadn't made friendships. First thing you do when you're raising money is you have to raise friends. So we are able to do that. We can offer a reception to a CEO who would never even, you know, look our way. Say, would you like to have Gorbachev in your home? That's a little different from saying, would you come here and come to the speaker series we have at the community college? So it's a draw. So it has its added value. Plus, the college is very, very proud that we're the only community college in the world that offers a speaker series. And it's an award-winning one, I say modestly. And they're proud of it. They're just very proud. They get a lot of attention.
Now, you're mixing with some of the best, but going back to your childhood, you grew up in a little town called Taft near Bakersfield in Southern California, a place you've described in the past as a dusty little oil town. Your father was a columnist for the local paper. You've come a long way from that. To what do you attribute your success?
Luck, I guess. I pinch myself every day. If I had thought when I was back there in that dusty oil town at Taft, 100 degrees in the shade, that I would be meeting some of these people, because it's so improbable. And it is such so much fun, but also a challenge, which we really need and want in life, to meet one of these people. And 98% of them are exactly what you expect them to be. There's very few surprises. And so it's been a long ways from Taft to Silicon Valley.
And you're working with celebrities. What is your definition of a celebrity?
Well, I was once asked that at San Jose Rotary Club, and I just flippantly said, anybody who can sell a ticket. I have what I call the free test. You know, would this, when I'm thinking about signing a speaker to the celebrity forum, would this person pass the free test? And that is, if I gave out free tickets all over Silicon Valley, would 7,000 people show up?
You've said your ego is so tied up in Celebrity Forum, you feel enormous pressure to have a good lineup. Can you tell me about the pressure and what, in your view, makes a good lineup?
Oh, there's nothing worse than having a bad speaker, and you never know for sure. I mean, you have a bad speaker now. The next day, I'm going to the Rotary Club. The day after that, I go to the chamber event, and then the gala for the Community School of Music and Arts, and I'm surrounded by these people who just had a bad experience, and I take it personally. Paulette and I have to be out there, but it really is a long month when the speaker is bad. And writers, oh, there are writers who are excellent speakers, and then there are writers who cannot speak at all.
Who's been your biggest disappointment, Dick?
Well,
can
I go
name names.
We're very disappointed in Toni Morrison, who is a wonderful writer, but she read some of her stuff and people didn't know, you know, what it meant. It wasn't, she didn't...
It wasn't accessible.
Didn't go into detail about what was she trying to say. So that was disappointing. Harry Belafonte went on way too long. He missed several chances to stop.
Can you tell us the story of Harry Belafonte? I hear there's a funny story.
Oh, yeah, he talked on and on. After the Monday, I got a handwritten fax that said, to Harry Belafonte, daylight come and me want to go home. Truman Capote, what he did basically was to read to us from his book. And I am a former English professor, and having him interpret it the way he wanted it interpreted to me was valuable, meant nothing to the audience. It was just some man standing up there reading a book, and you can't read to this audience. If you do too much of that, they really think they've been taken advantage of.
Can you share who's on your list for this coming year?
I'm going to start off with Tom Friedman, one of my favorite people, a friend. And he's told me, and he told me this the very first time he went off the stage, and he's been here for three times. He said, if you ever want me back, I will come back. And why is this important? Because he has so many offers, and many people are offering him $100,000. They don't care about the price. Now, I don't have $100,000, but many people do. And he prefers to come here. And there are a couple reasons. And one reason is our audience. Our audience is astute. They ask good questions. They're highly educated and well-read and up on current news. And he loves talking to a powerful crowd like that. And the other reason is he has a lot of friends here. He has friends at Google, friends at Apple. He has, and they're the top CEOs. He will have Japanese sushi dinner with Steve Jobs when he comes. They're very close, and he's close to Eric Schmidt and numbers of people. So this is where he wants to come. Cisco, John Chambers. He knows these people. So this is kind of like a second home to him here. So I'm very proud and confident when we start the series with Tom Friedman.
And I assume he's going to be talking about his new book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded.
Yeah, he is right on top of the Green Revolution. In fact, he's a change agent. He didn't just write about it. He helped change. He was there right alongside Al Gore when both of them were really pushing this, the need for this. And it's happening. It's really, we have a revolution. We have a Green Revolution. We're right in the middle of it, and it's not going to stop.
And I understand he was in Washington in January with John Doerr.
John Doerr is a very close friend of Tom Friedman.
And I understand, talking of the Green Revolution, Al Gore came here in October 2007, and he brought his famous slides from An Inconvenient Truth. Can you tell us why you picked him and give us a little background on Al Gore behind the scenes?
So there was no question I wanted to have him. A couple of interesting things happened during those days that he was here. One was a little scary. He, at the first night, at the end of the reception, which was held here on the campus and at Deanne's and the Petit Trianon, he said, Dick, I have to talk to you. And that's never good. And so he said, do we have a private room here? So we went over as the guests were leaving the reception and sat down, and he said, the president of China has called me, and I have to be in China tomorrow. And I have him on for two more nights.
Yes.
And this is nothing but a disaster as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's doable, but it is difficult. And he said, I can't very well say no. He said, the president plans tomorrow to announce this huge program we've been talking about. President Hu. Huge program about cutting down on the emissions in China. This is something that we've been hoping for, that we'd get this announcement. And so I simply said, well, Krishnamurti said, you are most free when you have no choice.
Yes.
And I'm free because I don't think I have a choice. Well, this really turned him on. He reads Krishnamurti. He says, you read Krishnamurti. So now we get started talking about Indian philosophy. And here I am about ready to have to cancel. So as soon as I got home, and this is midnight, I got on the computer and I let some friends know who were guests or some, you know, reception and all that, these certain personal friends I had to let know that this is being canceled tomorrow. And then, of course, my secretary, who hadn't come in, not there midnight, but would receive this message, and she would jump on it as soon as she got to work. And, of course, I had to be there. So I get to work late because I'm getting phone calls in the morning and people know. And when 8:30, he called me and said, it's all off.
What a relief.
I'm not going. Yeah. And so the second anecdote is that night we have the reception on the Foothill campus at the Krauss Center for Innovation. And the reception is over at 20 minutes to midnight. And I said goodnight to him, see you tomorrow. And I said, where are you going now? He said, I'm going to the airport to pick up Tipper. A Tipper's flying in. Well, I didn't think too much of that. And then on the way home, Paulette saying, you know, maybe he is going to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And sure enough, he won. He was shocked, he said. And I said, well, why did you have your wife there? He said, you know, you have to do this. Just in case, even if there's one chance out of 1,000, mm-hmm. you have to do it. And of course, the two of them together were all over television, all over the world. So it's a smart thing that he did it.
It's a good timing for you, Dick.
Oh, talk about luck. Mm-hmm. Well, I did schedule him at the time because I did know that he was nominated. But there were 1,000 people probably nominated. But I did know he's nominated, and I scheduled it at that time when it would be announced.
It was an exciting night. You've worked with celebrities for 41 years now, many big names of the last century. Who's still on your wish list?
Wish list is like a hope list, but it's almost a hopeless list, like Nelson Mandela, Steve Jobs. I would like to have Prince Charles. You just, you know, keep making your list and keep hoping that someday you might get a breakthrough on one of these.
You told me once, Dick, that you have a lot of people waiting in the wings, waiting, even praying for you to pass on the mantle. How do you deal with these keen young people? And do you have a message for them today?
Yeah, you might as well give up. I plan to take the Celebrity Forum through the 50th year, which is 9 years from now. And then after that, I will take one speaker at a time. Wheelchair, walker, or whatever it takes to me to get out there. If I can still speak, you're going to see me out there. So you guys waiting in line, you might as well forget it.
That's great, Dick. Well, it's been a real pleasure, Dick Henning. Thank you for taking the time to talk on Fresh Dialogues today.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you for listening to Fresh Dialogues. This is Allison Van Diggelen, with special thanks to Tom Kramkowski and Carol Pecora for technical support, and Kevin McLeod, who wrote and produced our music.